We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on NABBAclub.org, desperately in need, will hear our speaker, and we believe it's only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. We've got a good representation from the 7:30 early morning study group where our speaker comes from. And I'd like to introduce a man who never has a loss for words, a fellow member of the 7:30 early morning study group, Thomas End.
Good evening. My name is Thomas and I'm an alcoholic. Tim came to me and he said, can you do an introduction for the speaker? And I feel kind of like a warm-up comic for, you know, Billy Crystal. Whatever I have to say here is going to be forgotten by the end of the evening, but I also know why they put on the bad bands before the good bands come on. It's really to set them well up. But I just want to say that Bill is a personal friend of mine. He has been a stalwart member of the Early Morning Study Group. I find him amazingly adept in explaining this simple program in words that I can understand, so that when he speaks to the issues that are here, I hear him very carefully. I don't know why they have a cracker introducing a Cajun. Again, I can only figure out that it's part of Tim's warped sense of humor, but he is the entertainment committee chairman for this particular clubhouse, so I'm going to bow to his. So with all of that said, I'd like to introduce somebody who I think will really have a great message for us this evening, and that's Mr. Bilby. Thank you, sir.
Got the book, got some water, got a half of a cookie. That's all I need. My name is Bill Dillon. I'm an alcoholic. It's good to be here tonight. Thank you for that introduction, Thomas. That was very nice. That was certainly the most recent introduction I've ever had. So, I do like to just say up front that I am nervous. Usually when I share it's for 3 minutes, and I'm going to have a solid 3 minutes worth of sharing in here. It's going to cover with a lot of fluff for about another 42 minutes on top of it. So you'll have to bear with me. I came into AA on May the 23rd, 1979. And I've been sober since May the 23rd, 1979. Actually, that's not true. I came into AA probably like on May the 13th, 1979. Then I went out and got drunk for a few days and came in and got a white chip on the 23rd. But pretty much, actually, completely since May the 23rd of 79, I've been sober. When I came in, I was 17 years old, and I didn't like you people, and I didn't want what you had, and I wasn't going anywhere to get any of it. Just sign my damn slip and leave me alone. Thank you very much. I didn't feel like I had anything in common with you people in the rooms. Certainly I was going to be a potential alcoholic one day, given my family background. But I didn't have a problem, and that was obvious. Now, I did have some problems. I had some bad luck, and certainly I had a spate of frequent job changes, and I had a spate of frequent not arrests, but investigative detentions, I think is what I like to think of them as. I started drinking, and I guess you should know that I grew up in Southwest Louisiana. I grew up in Lafayette. I grew up in Cajun country. And we were poor, though. We were very poor. I couldn't even afford an accent down there. That's how poor we were. But I had a normal childhood, and I started drinking at 11, which is pretty typical in Louisiana. And by the time I was 14, I was drinking large amounts of beer on a regular basis. And I can still remember the first time I ever got access to unlimited beer. I decided I was going to pace myself, and I had, it was like a high school party thing. I was a freshman. I had 10 beers in 1 hour, and that was my pace. And when I got to the 10th beer, I knew that I was going to throw up, and I still had half a beer in the cup. And I thought, well, I'm going to need something to vomit into. So I drank that half a beer thinking this will give me a receptacle. And I threw up all over this poker table, and there was some very large gentlemen at the table, and they really didn't take to my disrupting the game. And one of the guys beat the snot out of me in the bathroom and bled all over my friend's car going home. And the next day, I had the most tremendous hangover. I can still remember how I felt, sitting out in my backyard looking at the river thinking, man, this is something. And, you know, I didn't drink again for a whole nother day. I couldn't wait to get that feeling of abandonment, that feeling of freedom. That it was like I had found the thing that made me fit in, at least from my perspective. And really from that point on, from the time I was 14 and until the time I came into AA, every opportunity that I had to drink until I got drunk, I took advantage of. And by the time I was probably 15, 15 and a half, I was a daily drinker, and I was having blackouts on a weekly basis. And I felt certain that was pretty normal because everybody that I hung out with did the same thing. And I had the immense foresight, though. I had the best job. I was the kid that made the donuts in the local donut shop. And so I knew every police officer on every beat, both for the parish and the city. And so whenever I got stopped, it was always, oh, this is Bill. He's okay. And instead of giving me a ride to the police station, they'd give me a lecture and they'd give me a ride home. And so I had these frequent interactions with police officers that otherwise would have cuffed me and stuffed me, but instead they took care of me. And all during this time period, I grew up in an alcoholic household. So my father was an alcoholic. My older brother, who was my mentor, was an alcoholic, and my younger sister was an alcoholic and a drug addict. And then I had a mentally ill sister and a mentally ill brother who sort of kept it interesting. Seven kids, and out of the seven kids, most of us were alcoholics or drug addicts. So I didn't have an ideal household. And my mom thought that it would be great for me to go to Alateen. So starting at 13, I was going to Alateen every Thursday night, and it was great because those guys would buy beer after the meetings. And so we would all go out and drink beers after the Alateen meetings. And I really liked those meetings, and I was working the steps and learning a lot about alcoholism because, well, you know, it was right there at the AA clubhouse, and so you got to see real live alcoholics, but alcoholics that were in recovery. And I told my story when I was like, I don't know, 16 with an Alateen, and everybody was, you know, of course it wasn't my real story, but it was that nice Alateen story. But I was drinking a lot, and you know, I qualified. I mean, you know, there's no, I was thinking tonight, you know, the things that, you know, let me know the warning signs. And all. I mean, if you've ever been too drunk to fish, you may have a problem with alcohol. Or my personal favorite was if you have ever been too drunk to participate in Mardi Gras, you may be an alcoholic. And one of the things that happened to me when I was, I guess I was in that final descent. And we all go into it. After you've been in AA a while, you can recognize what was happening before you hit your bottom. And so I was to the point where I was drinking on a blackout basis every week. And in my hometown, we had Mardi Gras every year, you know, Fat Tuesday, big parade. And I went to Mardi Gras. And my general rule was that I would drink until I could no longer walk, and then I knew it was time to drive home. And it was a rainy Mardi Gras. It was kind of like weather's like it is today. And I got so drunk that I could no longer walk. So I got in my car, and I'm driving down the road through the rain. And this police officer pulled out from the curb, and he sideswiped my car. That was bad. And I couldn't get out of the car because I was too drunk to walk. So he comes over to my car, and fortunately, he was apparently drunker than I was. And all he was interested in was that we didn't call his supervisor. And so I'm a cocky 16-year-old alcoholic, and I got a police officer asking me for a favor, which I thought was a pretty cool thing. So we agreed that he would pay to fix my car and that I wouldn't call his supervisor and everything would be fine. And, of course, you know, I'm a teenage kid. I got this hot rod car. It's like my whole world. And so I got the car fixed and, you know, I give him the bill. And he's like, oh, hell no, I am not paying that. You don't have a police report on this. So I did what any budding cocky alcoholic would do. I filed a lawsuit against this guy and served the papers on him during shift change at the police station. If you have to walk on thin ice, you might as well dance. And I had estimates and this and that and affidavits and photos of the car before and after. And I was suing him for the sum of like, it was $700. The car was only worth $300, but it had $700 worth of... And I'll tell you where the story's going later when I get to law school, but... So I sued this guy. And, of course, I continued to drink, and I'm drinking at my same bar every week, and yada, yada, and so the Saturday before I'm due to go to court, I'm too drunk to walk, so it's time to drive home. I'm driving home in the rain. It's Louisiana, and this car pulls out behind me, and I mean, like, really close behind me, and puts his high beams on. And so I make a turn. This car makes a turn. I go zipping down this street. This car follows me, and I'm thinking, oh, it's this police officer. This is not good. So I take the .22 that I keep under my seat, and I put it in my coat pocket, and we go screaming down Main Street, and I pull into this sort of a honky-tonk, and it turns out it's not the police officer that's following me, but somebody else who just wants to fight or something. And anyway, it's a much bigger guy than me. When I was drinking, I seemed to have this habit that people that were bigger than me wanted to fight me a lot. And I thought it was something about the way that I looked, but you know, in 33 years of sobriety, I haven't had anybody want to fight me. Certainly not anybody bigger than me, because usually I am very polite to those people now. But in any event, this guy wanted to fight me, and so I talked him out of it, and I felt really good about that part of the evening, until the pistol sort of sagged out of my pocket, and he saw the gun, and he grabbed it, and then he knocked the snot out of me, and I'm like on the ground, and he throws the pistol against the wall of this street joint. And of course, by then there's a crowd of people, almost as big as this room, I think, that are out there watching. And so I'm picking myself out of the gravel parking lot, and I can hear the sirens coming from both directions, and I always knew that was a bad sign. So I run, go get my pistol, and I jump in the car, but this is a fast car. So even drunk, I outrun the police. I feel real good about that part of the night. And go to court Monday morning. Remember, this is the Saturday before I'm due to go to court. And I have my court case. First court case of my life. And I should tell you now, I'm a pretty good lawyer today. But back then, I was still learning. So I put on all of my evidence. And it was in front of a judge that had known me from other occasions as a youth. And I put on my case. And Judge Flynn listened to it. And then he said, well, you know what? We're going to recess for 10 minutes and let you guys... see if you can't come to a resolution here. So he sticks us both in the jury room, me and Officer Green. And Officer Green sits there. He's got a big knife, and he's just picking his nails for 10 minutes. Doesn't say a word. I'm 16. I'm 17. I don't know what's going on. The bailiff knocks on the door, says the judge is ready. Officer Green looks up at me, and he says, I heard you dropped your gun the other night. Well, okay, we're settling this case. Which I did, but I got stopped a lot by the police after that. I still got $300 out of the guy. I felt pretty good about that part of it. But the thing that was happening to me is that these problems were occurring more and more often. You know, and I got rid of the pistol the day of court because I knew that me having guns was not a good idea. And I had an older brother. Remember I was telling you when I started my story, I had a brother who was an alcoholic, and he was kind of my mentor. And he was... I guess 8 years older than me, and he was just flunking out of law school. And so he came home to explain that he was flunking out of law school, and he sat down, he told me he was going to AA meetings, and then he told me my story. He told me everything that had been happening in his drinking career, and he was 26 at the time, and it was everything that was happening in my drinking career. And it really scared me. So I decided at that point, that I was going to really control my drinking, that from now on I was going to do a lot better. And I wasn't going to have these blackouts. I wasn't going to drink to excess. I was going to have just 3 beers a night. And that I wasn't going to end up like him, a big loser in AA. The next 3 months, things got really bad for me. And, you know, it was one of those things that was just kind of like the train just completely came off the rails. And I lost a series of jobs, and I had a lot of unfortunate things happen. But the last thing that happened, now we can have a meeting. The last thing that happened was I got drunk one night. I was too drunk to walk, but I had a carload of people with me. And across the center line going 50 miles an hour, and I hit a friend of mine's mother going 50 miles an hour head on. No seatbelts. But, you know, the problem with an alcoholic like me is, you know, I'm drinking a lot of beer and I'm throwing the cans in the back seat. And when you have a head-on collision, all those empty cans come flying to the front with the inertia. And then when you get out, you knock out 20 or 30 empty beer cans onto the highway. But the police took me home because I was Bill, the guy from the donut shop. And they took me home, and my whole face was just covered in glass because I wasn't wearing a seatbelt. And you know, I still find glass in my forehead from time to time. A little piece will work its way up just to remind me that I'm powerless over alcohol and inertia. And so I started going to those damn AA meetings in May of 1979. And I didn't like you people, and I didn't want what you had, and I had a sponsor, but he'd never worked the steps. And so we'd go to meetings every day, and we'd drink coffee every night, and we'd talk about how terrible it was that we couldn't drink anymore. And I was getting more and more. I never thought about killing myself until I came into these rooms. And at the end of the year, I'd quit school. I was living in Lafayette and going to a little community college there, and I quit school, and I'd gone to work offshore for a while, and then I had gotten the bright idea that there was like a young people's group in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, so I moved to Baton Rouge, and I got this little apartment. It's a little apartment, only little area town I could move into, and it was called Spanish Town, and I was living there about 2 months before I found out that everybody in the neighborhood was gay except for me. I had all these friendly neighbors. All these guys were coming over wanting to have dinner with me and bringing bottles of wine and stuff. And I'm like, I don't drink. We were the girls in this neighborhood. And so I was kind of pissed about the guy that set me up with the apartment. It was such a great deal. But I was getting angry and angry and more depressed and more depressed. And so I decided to go into treatment. With a year of dry time under my belt, I went into treatment in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I had insurance, and so they took me in, and I was doing it as a day program. It wasn't inpatient. I was going and then working at night. And after 3 weeks of doing this treatment program, they gave me what they called a therapeutic discharge, which is, you are screwing it up for everybody else in the unit, so we want you to leave. And that is really when I felt that I could hear the gates of hell clanging closed on me. Because here was a group of professionals that were saying, you know, there's just nothing we can do for you. You know, you don't want this thing, and you just need to go out and drink some more. And it was also at the time of the World Convention of AA in New Orleans. So this was like, you know, May of 1980. And so they have 30,000 drunks in the Superdome. And I've got a ticket to the AA World Convention. And I go there with a bunch of my friends. And somehow or other, on Saturday night, I got separated from the group. And so I'm sitting in the Superdome in the nosebleed section. And I'm crying in my beer. Well, I don't have the beer yet, but I'm crying in my coffee. And I have $5 in my pocket. And I can't wait because I know where I can go to get drunk for $5. And it's like, you know, this AA thing just sucks. And I am going to go get drunk. And so I wait for the speaker to finish. This is the keynote speaker on Saturday night at the World Convention. I'm thinking, I'm going to be the only guy to go out and get drunk tonight. And I throw open the door of the Superdome, and there stands my sponsor and his wife. And one of the things you'll notice in AA is that you're going to get these little miracles. And every now and then, God's just going to take care of you. And that night, God took care of me. And this guy, Mike, who was my new sponsor, had worked the steps. And he sat me down that weekend, and he made me work the steps. And, you know, before I had all these Hazelden books and all these really long inventories. I had like 260-page inventories and 2 8-hour-long fifth steps. And my first sponsor fell asleep during the second one of them. It was so damn boring. It was awful. But my new sponsor, Mike, had worked the steps. And so he knew how to make it simple. Because the reality is, when I came in here, I knew every damn thing there was about AA because I had already been. I had a degree in Alateen. And so, you know, they talk about contempt prior to investigation in here. And the people that know a whole lot have a lot harder time getting sober. I've never met anybody who was too stupid to get it in here, but I met a lot of people that were too smart. And I was almost one of those people. But I got this good sponsor, and he sat me down. And, you know, I was so angry at God. Because from my perspective, it's like God had made me an alcoholic at 17 years old, and he put me into this just wickedly twisted family, and I felt like I didn't even have a shot at it. You know, it's like, how am I going to have a normal life here? And so I would go to the park every Sunday, and I would cuss at God for an hour. It's like my little church service. And I would cuss at God for everything that he had done to me that week and everything he'd done to me in life and screw up my life. And I did this faithfully for about 3 months. And at the end of 12 Sundays, I started looking at it going, you know, a lot of things that are happening in my life that are really screwing it up are things that I'm doing to myself. And I started talking to my sponsor about that, and he's like, well, you know, it's because you're running your own life. And that's when the light sort of clicked. Because the reality is, the fundamental difference, the people that are working the program and what I was doing, whereas the people in here that were working the 12 steps, they were turning their will and their lives over to the care of God. And I was just trying to manage things better and better. Because now that I'm sober, now that I'm not drinking, I can handle things a lot better than I could. And I can tell you right now, after 33 years in AA, I can't handle managing. My life is none of my business. Pure and simple. But see, at the time, though, I thought, man, now I'm going to be a good manager. And I just give me those controls and we'll make things happen. And gradually, these little Sunday things, when I went to cuss at God for an hour, I started realizing, you know, I'm screwing things up. God ain't picking on me. I'm picking on me. But I had this good sponsor. And I got to the fourth step. And I like to talk about the fourth step because that, to me, is really where the rubber hits the road. I mean, you can do the first three steps, and Lord knows that third step prayer is a potent tool. And I try and say it every day, a dozen times a day. But when you get to the fourth step, you've actually got to do something. You got to pick up a pen, and you got to look at your own life in a real hard way with bright lights and take off the sugar coating on it. And I didn't know how to do that. But I had this great sponsor, and he took me to the big book. And I didn't even know the steps were in the big book. I thought they were in the 12 and 12. He said, no, you kind of need to read the book again. So he opened it up, and he took me to page 86, which, see, I carry the book with me because when I get to this part of my story, I like to know the page number. He takes me to page 86, which isn't the fourth step. I'm like, well, what's the deal here? He says, no, this is the 10th step. Well, all right, 84. But I was close. I was actually reading this before tonight. You know, it's kind of like if I ran out of stuff to say, I'll at least have those steps in there. Page 84. And in the middle of page 84, it says, continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And Mike sat me down. He said, Bill, you've had all these big Hazelden books, and you've had all these 80-page fifth steps, fourth steps. He says, but really, you have only four character defects: selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. And he got four sheets of paper, and he wrote on the first one, selfishness, and on the next one, dishonesty, and the next one, resentment and fear. And then he took me to the 12 and 12, and we opened that up. And the 12 and 12 talks about your three instincts. And your three instincts are for sex, security, and society. And we wrote that on the top for three more pages. I had 7 pages of paper. He said, this is all you can use to do your 4-step. It's all you need. And I wrote down all the areas of my life where I was selfish, all of the dishonesties that I had, all the resentments that I had. And it was recurring patterns over and over again. It didn't matter what hair color my girlfriend had. I was going to have the same relationship with her. It didn't matter what business I was in. My employer was going to be the same sort of jerk as the one before that. And the problems I was going to have with my coworkers were the same in every job. And it was because everywhere I went, I took me along. 33 years into sobriety, there are only 2 groups of drivers on the road. They're idiots, which are the people that are moving slow and are in front of me. And they're maniacs, which are the people that are driving fast and are behind me. It's the same. And so when I sat down with those 4 sheets of paper, I could make it simple enough that even I could understand it. And you know, 3 decades later, I still have those 7 sheets of paper. I still have those same 4 character defects. I still have those same 3 instincts run amok. But it's not to the same degree as it was when I first came in. You know, now I recognize it when I'm lying to you. Now with a little guidance, I recognize when I'm lying to me. See, that's the real problem with dishonesty. It really isn't that I'm lying to you. Because you're going to hear my crap and go, well, you know, whatever. See, I'm going to walk away believing it. You know, sometimes for years, sometimes over and over again through, you know, innumerable relationships with employers and girlfriends and wives and children and whatever it is. But when I came in AA, I had the opportunity to get a better set of tools. And that's really what the program is about. It's about getting a better set of tools. You know, I grew up Catholic, and there's probably some recovering Catholics in here. I still like to go to Mass once a year with my mama just to make sure that I can't go. And I never did really understand their interpretation of the Ten Commandments, but it works for a lot of people. There are millions of people that have found solace in the church, and they go every week. You know, but for me, every time I go to Mass, every time I go to a church service, the whole time I'm comparing it to a decent AA meeting, and they always come up short. You know, I walk away with my cup full from my home group. You know, I'm a member of the 7:30 early morning study group, and I hit it 2 or 3 times a week after 30 years of sobriety. And if you don't walk away from your home group feeling like it's the best group around, then you need to come to my group. You know, get your butt out of bed, get you some coffee, and come on down here at 7:30. Because we're working out of the books down here. And we don't skip around. We start at the beginning and we go all the way through, even the prefaces and the appendices and all that stuff, everything but the copyrights. But see, I need that. Because as somebody with a mind of a chronic alcoholic, it's too easy for me to get off track. It's too easy for me to lose sight of what's important. And what's important is to keep my balance and to keep my focus. And see, I only do that through daily maintenance. And that's the real kicker for me, is that if I do the daily maintenance, then I can have a great life. Now, a great life doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to be rich, or good looking, or have my full head of hair, or any of the stuff that I for years thought was, you know, those were the check marks, the indicia of success. You know, but today I have peace of mind. Today I have friends. Today I get invited back to places. You know, when I was drinking, I might get invited places, but I never got invited back. You know, and today I have real relationships with people. Relationships where I actually relate to people, where I exchange ideas instead of just taking turns talking, which is what I did in the bar rooms. And you know, I think about that from time to time. My father was, as I mentioned, an alcoholic, and when I first got sober, I would go to his bar, and it was like visiting the ghost of Christmas future. You know, and it was one of these places. It was at one point it had been a chicken coop, and so they called it the Chicken Coop Lounge. And my father was a very influential businessman in his community. And he was basically a high roller in a low roller bar. And so it was one of these places where, you know, the only illumination was like a Coors Light sign in the corner. And so you'd walk in and had one of these crushed shell gravel parking lots and bright white parking lots in Louisiana. So you'd walk in there, you'd have all this reflected light, and then the door would shut behind you, and it was like a cave, you know, and there was this one little light in the back corner, and you'd stand there. You couldn't even move because you might trip over somebody. And my father would call me over, "Oh, that's my son, come on over here." And I would have a Coke and sit there with him while he drank. And I would look around at his relationships and his life and ask myself, is this really where I want to end up? Or am I willing to take a risk and do what the people in AA are doing? And I miss my dad. You know, in 1984 is the first time in my life I ever spent Father's Day with my dad. My dad had one of these things where he always went home to Missouri because he wanted to impress his parents with how successful he was. So every Father's Day, he would fly to Missouri where he grew up, and he would spend like all this money that he had showing his parents how successful a businessman he was. And in 1984, he didn't do that. We spent Father's Day together, and he taught me how to grill chickens, and it was a wonderful day. And, you know, at that point, I had 5 years of sobriety, and I told my dad, I said, "You know, it's time, Dad. You know, it's really time for you to stop. You know, your liver's given out. Your doctors have told you that you can't carry on like this anymore." And he looked me in the eye, and he said, "I know you're right, son, but I'm not ready yet." And he was absolutely right. Now, when I came into AA, there was a little French guy. His name was Ronnie. And Ronnie told me, he said, "You know, Bill, there's a word in this program, and there's a word that you young people out there need to have. And I see a couple of you out there, really young people. How old are you? 19? Yeah. It's a three-letter word that's going to affect your whole life. It's the most important word in all of AA. And you know what that word is? It's not God. The three-letter word that's going to affect your life is yet. You know, so you can look around this room at these old farts that have lost everything. Thomas, stand up and wave your hand. Don't you laugh, Jim. You just haven't gotten there yet. But you get to decide how far down the escalator or the elevator shaft you want to ride. And that is the beauty of AA, is that everybody gets to decide when they're going to stop. You can stop right now and start having a better life. It's going to suck for a while, I'll tell you right now. All your friends that are 19 years old and out there hitting the streets are going to have a lot more fun than you will this weekend, except for the people that get arrested. All right? You know, those guys are temporarily not having as much fun. But when I came in, I was having a miserable time. And it was because I didn't know how to have fun. And so I had to, you know, everybody else was out drinking and carrying on, doing all these things and having a lot of easy fun. And I had to learn how to have fun. I had to learn how to dance. You know, and sober, I was so self-conscious, it was awful. You know, but I finally learned a few steps, and what do you know? I had a couple of guys that in AA that we would go out together, and this one fellow was, he was a Vietnam vet. He was a little older than the rest of us. And he used to say, "Now, gentlemen, what we have here is we have a tactical advantage." And I said, "Well, Will, what do you mean?" He said, "Well, see, all these other guys have been buying women drinks all night long, and it's 11 o'clock, and we're showing up sober, and all we have to do is show up to look good." He said, "We're dancing better, we're talking better." He said, "If anybody's going to have a good time between 11 o'clock and 1 in the morning, it's going to be us." And that's exactly how your life can be. You can have a great life but you got to work those damn steps. You know, and easy fun, it ain't going to happen for a while. But if you're willing to work at having fun, if you're willing to say, you know, maybe I don't know how to dance. Maybe I don't know how to do whatever it is. I decided I wanted to do whitewater canoeing and kayaking, and so I took that up. And for a while, every weekend, I was up on the Nantahala just paddling. You know, and for 2 years, that was my compulsion, and it was great. And then after that, I took 200 miles of the Appalachian Trail. And I had some good times doing that. And then I found some women that wanted to kayak. And you know what? That was even better. And my repertoire got better and better. But you know, back to 1984, when the last time I saw my dad, he said he wasn't ready yet. And I said, well, Dad, we're going to be carrying you out soon. And I'm going to be doing that. If you don't stop drinking, I will be carrying you out soon. And you know, a month later, he was dead. He died on the 4th of July. He went out with a bang. And I was off on a canoe trip with a beautiful young woman, as I recall. They were going to send a helicopter out to find me because they knew I was off on a river, but they didn't know where. And so they held the funeral up until I could get back. And I had agreed to be the pallbearer. And so, you know, normally the children wouldn't do something like that, but I made a commitment, so I did it. And I'm riding with all of these guys that were my father's friends for years. And of course, we're sort of cut off from the rest of the herd. And so they all start telling stories about my father. And his brother was one of them. And, you know, I always had a really strained relationship with my father. I never felt like he loved me, and I didn't understand why. But when I talked to his brother who had gotten sober in AA, I might add, he explained it all to me. Yeah, I got time. And it was great because it was one of those little AA miracles. And see, what had happened is my father was born at home. And back then, they had a midwife to administer anesthesia, and they didn't do it like they do now. And the woman that was doing the anesthesia didn't know what she was doing. And so every time my father was about to be born, she would administer the anesthesia, and labor would stop. And this went on for like 2 days. And my grandmother's back was broken in two places, though. And she was, you know, I got this mental illness in my family, and she was one of those people that had mental illness. And she decided that my father was evil because this had happened. And so the good son had dinner with the family at the dining room table, but my father took his meals in the kitchen. And he grew up not feeling loved by his mom his whole life and had this huge chip on his shoulder. And so his whole thing in life was that he was going to be a success and he was going to show his mom what a success he was. And so every year at Father's Day, he would go back home and spend $1,000 on his dad just to show his mom how important he was and what a success he had become. And his whole life, all of his values were caught up in how much money he could throw around. And so he would go up to his hometown and throw around all this money. He was buying my cousin's cars on years when we didn't even have shoes because that was where his mind was. And suddenly I realized that my father never loved me because my father never knew what it was to love people. And then I looked back at those 7 pages in my inventory. And I said, well, you know, I had a really bad roadmap for the first 17, 18 years of my life. But now I have a group of people that love me. And in this room, I have a group of people that love me. And I don't have to throw my money around to show that I love you. I don't have to prove anything here. All I really have to do is be here. And you know, it's a different kind of a love. And I didn't have it in my family. I didn't have it in my family growing up. And I'll tell you, the last 30 years, I still don't have it in my family. But I have it here. And just spending that one day with my father's brother at his funeral, big pieces of my life came together. But I could only appreciate that because I had done an inventory and I knew what my basic handicaps were. If I hadn't done that, it would have been completely over my head and I would have missed it. And you know what I'd be doing right now? I'd be making a whole lot more money than I am right now. I'd be showing my kids what a fine father I am by providing for them, which is what my daddy did. And you know what I don't do to my kids? I don't give them stuff. I spend a lot of time with my kids. I go camping with my kids. I go fishing with my kids. You know, my kids want to buy something. It's like, man, that's a great idea. How much money do you have? And they go, you are just the meanest dad. You know, they already know, you know. I'm just not going to do it. You know, so I live a much more simple life, but the relationships that I have today are genuine. And the success that I have in my life is a direct result of the loving relationships that I have with people in my life. It's a totally different yardstick of success. Now, sometimes I sit around and I go, well, you know, my 12-year-old pickup truck that I have to drive around isn't as nice as some of the cars that people that have got 6 months of sobriety are driving. But, you know, I'm all right with that. Because it's choices that I'm getting to make today. And that's the beauty of living the AA program, is that today I get to make the choices. And when I was drinking, all the authority figures in my life got to make the choices. And even in these rooms today, I mean, I don't have to go back 30 years. And you can look at the newcomers and go, well, you just don't get to make as many choices right now. Your probation officer's making choices for you. The judge is making choices for you. Now, at this juncture, I should note that I did go back to college, and after sitting down and doing a thorough inventory, I could see that dishonesty was one of my fundamental character flaws, and so I went to law school because I thought that would be a good way to make a living if you have a dishonesty problem. And I worked as a federal prosecutor for 25 years helping people get honest. And I specialized in crimes where businessmen would come in and do bribery and stuff like that. And I really was really enjoyed my job because, having grown up in Louisiana, I had seen so much corruption from every side that I knew how to work those cases. You know, a year ago, the government decided they were closing my office. And I was so upset because I had all this uncertainty. And once again, just like before, I'm like, God, how could you do this to me? I got bills to pay. I got things to do. You know, oh, my life is so bad. And it's a process. You know, and we all have to go through our season of complaining and whining, whatever you want to call it. You know, change is not comfortable for any of us. But 3 months ago, I took the retirement package. I got to looking at the fine print, and it's like, oh, you're going to give me a pension right now? Yeah, I'll leave. And now I have my own business. And now I'm getting to make the choices again. You know, I get to decide what it is I want to do. But all of this is a direct result of working those 12 steps. And if I work the steps in my daily life, then I have great days. And if I decide not to, if I decide I'm just going to manage my way through this thing today, I can have very frustrating times in life. And I can get to the point, occasionally I still want to drink. And you know what? I'm kind of glad of that. It keeps me on my toes. It reminds me that I still have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I'm not one of these people that can skip a lot of meetings. And if a week goes by and Bill Dillon hadn't been to a meeting, something's wrong. Because it's part of my maintenance. And I need it to keep my balance. Now, there's other things that I have to do, too. I have to sleep at least 5 or 6 hours a night. And, got to eat a couple meals a day, and if I run three or four times a week, then that keeps me from saying everything that I'm thinking, which is often not a good idea. At least my wife thinks that it's not a good idea. I tend to agree with her. I like sleeping inside. I was telling her yesterday that when we first got married, you know, till death do us part was a vow, and now it's kind of an objective, but now we've been married for 20 years, and we have a great home. You know, I look at the household I grew up in, and I compare it to what we have now, you know, and it makes me cry, because, you know, my kids, 27, 16, and 10, they still want to hang out with me. They still want to hang out with me and their mom. You know, we talk about vacations, and it's kind of like, well, can't we spend 3 weeks next summer going on a trip together? And I'm thinking, man, when I was 16, I did not want to spend 3 days with my parents. But it's a direct result of working these steps. And as long as I make that the focus in my life, then the quality of my problems continues to get better and better. And I'm afraid to be where I would be if I didn't do it that way. You know, I was talking to somebody before the meeting tonight. I have a friend who went into rehab the same year I did, same my age. He was having the same life just in New Orleans instead of Lafayette. And he did rehab when he was 17, and he became a treatment counselor for a couple of years. And he got away from it. And this guy, he can drink a couple of beers and put it down, and I've seen him do it on several occasions. And I just don't understand that at all. I've never wanted to have two beers in my life. I see people do that, and it's like, what the hell are you thinking? But I think that's what normal people do. You know, I think it's like if I was a glutton, I would want to have three or four meals at a sitting, but that's what I do with booze. And I've always wanted to do that with booze. And I never wanted to have a pleasant buzz and just maintain that. You know, that buzz phase, I saw that buzz phase as I was passing through, you know. And when I think about drinking today, that's still how I think about drinking. Every once in a while, I'll start entertaining that and wondering what it would be like if I drank a bunch of Grano, because it's the same result. You know, I mean, it really is. It's just going to go right through me. And I can't afford that today. Today, I have a good life. And you people are a big part of that life for me. Because when I come to a room like this, and when I'm not just blithering on for an hour, but you people are sharing, it's like you're holding up mirrors for me to see myself. And I never walk away from a meeting where I don't have something I can think about, where I don't have something I can go, you know what? You know, that guy was right. I need to be thinking about what it is that he said. Or that woman who's changed so much said something for me to gnaw on and think about during the day. You people are saving my life. And I can't thank you enough for it. Thanks for having me.
Thank you, Bill. That's what we call working it. Yes, indeed.
Someone's hand. carry me when I'm tired. I got to go. I can't stay here no more. I mean, old bartender just showed me the door. Somewhere, somehow, I'll win my fight someday, and we'll all be together on that broad on that broad highway.